This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on www.prn.fm. This radio presentation replays my weekly TV show, Refounding America with Peter R. Breggin, MD, which can be watched on Brighteon.tv, and it's available on Roku. I interview guests who are heroes and pioneers in confronting the global predators who are behind COVID-19 lockdowns and vaccines, corrupt public health and medicine, global warming, the Great Reset, and other justifications for destroying the Western democracies. They are stealing our countries, our freedoms, our dignity and hope, and our jobs and our savings. For documentation of this worldwide tragedy, read our new book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey, by Peter and Ginger Breggin. Together, my guests and I explore what is happening and what we each can do to refound America and inspire the world. Thank you for your courage in facing these challenges and standing up for liberty. Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. Oh, welcome, my wonderful, wonderful audience, to Refounding America, which goes along with reclaiming ourselves. I'm Dr. Peter Breggin. I hope most of you know me. Well, I hope a lot of you don't, that this will be your first time watching the show. You're on Brighteon TV, a wonderful TV station. We are seen on Roku. It makes us real. You can actually go in front of your TV set, and almost all TV sets now, and tune in Brighteon on Roku. And if some of you might be listening to me on the radio at PRN.live, you're listening to the radio version of the TV show. Today, we only got 9 seconds. We have like a war correspondent of COVID-19 going to be on, an embedded war correspondent. See you soon. All right, my wonderful audience. We are here with Mike Capuzzo. Before I introduce him a little more, I want to remind you that Ginger Breggin and I are the authors of COVID-19 and the Global Predators. We Are the Prey, and it's now been sold over 100,000 copies. We thought we were going to sell 500 out of our garage. So it's been a stunning success. Much of it sold direct to the public at the cheaper price off of our special dedicated website for that, which is wearethepray.com. To follow us, I always forget to put this stuff in, so I'm going to put it at the beginning today. To follow us, go to Breggin.com and get our Breggin... I've only been doing this one for 30 years or something. Our Breggin Alerts, bless me. Our Breggin Alerts. We've got tens of thousands of people who get this. Right now, I think it's about 48,000. And that people love it. We had an opening rate this week of over 50%. That is unheard of for internet materials like this, for internet newsletters or alerts like this. And it just shows that people are getting a lot out of it and they want to check it out almost every week, you know, at least every other week. Things are going here good with the book. You can get it on Amazon too, and you can get the ebook on Amazon. It's still acknowledged by just about everybody to be the deepest dive there is into who are the predators behind COVID-19. Now, Mike Capuzzo is a really good man in terms of this kind of investigation. Ginger, who has been in very close touch with Mike for quite some time, I've been in touch with him as well, just admires the hell out of him. And she views Mike as an embedded journalist in the ivermectin wars. And he's also, in addition to that, he's been nominated for 6 Pulitzer Prizes. You were probably so good they couldn't give you one because they don't give them to the best person, but they had to nominate you. And he's a marvelous writer. The book you wrote, just a quick, the book you wrote about sharks, is that actually what that shark story, the true story that you tell? It's so incredibly well written. Is that a shark story that became the basis of the shark movie? Or is that
Peter, thank you. Yes, I wrote a book. It was a New York Times bestseller called Close to Shore. And it's, you know, true story. It was so-called literary journalism written like a novel, but true and documented. And going back in time to 1916, and it's the sort of most thorough story, the first story that rediscovered the true story that led to Jaws, which was the series of, of 4 or 5 deaths on the Jersey Shore that Peter Benchley later exploited in Jaws.
Well, I can't write like that. I have 2 published novels, folks, from my early days, 1972, 73. I'm not a novelist. This man writes so beautifully. Dr. Pierre Corey, Cory, is blessed to have this man writing his book for him, writing a book with him. And Dr. Corey, of course, is really the major figure, if not the major figure, in the development of ivermectin. I got started with all the guys who were doing hydroxychloroquine. So I had to, in the middle of the book, catch up on ivermectin and get stuff in the book about ivermectin. But you were like with them. How did you get embedded in them? And I think it would be an interesting story and help people understand this whole process of trying to get really good treatments accepted.
Thanks, Peter. I heard Pierre Corey, his first testimony in front of the U.S. Senate, the Senator Ron Johnson's Homeland Security Committee, which was long before his ivermectin testimony that got almost 9 million views on YouTube before it was taken down. He gave historic testimony, really, in May, Mother's Day. I heard it happened on May 6th. Of 2020. And he and his mentor, Dr. Paul Merrick, the most published critical care doctor in American history and the most published ever, who also treats patients, and 3 other academic critical care, highly published doctors, had discovered that the WHO, the NIH were, and who knows if it was done deliberately, but they were definitely suppressing the use of steroids, which has turned out these doctors were saving 95 to 100% of the patients with steroids and vitamin C and some other like FDA approved generics in the spring of 2020, which as you'll recall was when 80% of ICU patients, like, you know, beyond the death rates of the Black Death, were dying in the top hospitals in New York City. And I realized when I heard this testimony from someone who at the time had recently been a highly published professor at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, head of the Trauma and Life Support Center in Madison, one of the top academic medical schools in the country, that he had all the credentials that should lead journalists to, and his mentors and his colleagues had overwhelming credentials as some of the top critical care doctors in pulmonology, pulmonary care and critical care that were, you know, sort of facing being devastated by COVID and would know the most about COVID and would beating it. And we look back even before hydroxychloroquine, it wasn't before hydroxychloroquine, to say co-parallel with it. If their steroid recommendations have been immediately adopted, we could have closed down the pandemic in the spring of 2020 when maybe, 18,000 Americans had died. So that was my first wide open, sort of brick on the head to tell me something was really wrong with journalism and with medicine. And I didn't know at the time what it was. I hadn't gone into the incredible depth your incredible book you did with Ginger goes into, but I knew something was really rotten. And I knew that more so that I couldn't live in a world where the journalists who were some of my oldest colleagues and former friends at the New York Times and the Washington Post, because I was at major newspapers for a lot of my career, were withholding the treatment in a pandemic that would save the world, And so that was an astonishing moment. So I called Pierre and said, listen, I've got to do a book on you.
When did you meet him? And I'd just like to hear more data on this. Be a historian for us on all this.
Sure. He and his colleagues invited me to meet them in the first, they founded the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, FLCCC.net. And he and Dr. Merrick were responsible for getting treatments out all around the world that helped save, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people, especially when it later came to ivermectin. Merrick is the one who, in October of 2020, discovered the data signal coming from a number of small but highly persuasive studies in Peru and elsewhere, and did an historic podcast about that. And I went to Madison, Wisconsin with them when they all met to convene that nonprofit and begin to work together. And I went to the Florida COVID summit with them just past January to watch them, as well as Dr. Malone and the guys you've worked with, McCulloch and others, present. And it's just been fascinating because ivermectin, Pierre Corey will freely admit that the worst suppression of medicine ever is what you documented in your book, and is hydroxychloroquine. On the other hand, I think of ivermectin as a tie, because I think if you had to take one drug with you on a deserted island to face COVID, it would be ivermectin, and the second one would be hydroxychloroquine. It's just unthinkable what's happened with both of these drugs.
By the way, did you ever feel there was any competition between the doctors who were promoting hydroxychloroquine and the ones who were promoting ivermectin?
I haven't paid much attention to that. I my general thoughts on that are, as a journalist, I'm just absolutely astonished by the work you've done, Pierre Corey's done, the writings that Robert Malone does, Peter McCulloch, all you guys, doctors, are just geniuses. And I think at the time when civilization needs you to survive, you step forward to become journalists too. And so my sense of that is that as all these various new media stars have gone off to their own way, that there's a great camaraderie, a great support.
Yes, I think there certainly is.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably some of the inevitable human jockeying if you're all looking for the same sources of money or something, of nonprofits. People are...
I don't think that goes on much. There isn't much money like that.
So I think these
docs are paying for it themselves or for their work, a lot of it. I think ivermectin, folks, has got more evidence for being helpful to people who are really sick. And it's generally agreed upon that hydroxychloroquine is very, very good for the early stages, first 4 or 5 days that you've got a fever and a cough, get that into you. And and in general, people are saying that ivermectin is better in the hospital, and the hydroxychloroquine advocates have never claimed that it was very good for very sick patients. And that was part of the ruse that was used against it. It would only be tested on very sick patients, not on the patients that the doctors were using it on.
Right.
And then they actually, and document this in the book with absolute certainty, they purposely poisoned sick patients with overdoses of hydroxychloroquine. And then the AMA would put these obviously horrendous studies up online to tell doctors don't go near it, and the New York Times put stuff up, you know, within 2 or 3 days of when the doc, these particular doctors put it up themselves, just on their own online. The New York Times picked it up within, I think, 1 day or 2 days, obviously connected, and then the AMA puts it up on their website. And I think that was probably one of the most important things in freaking people out, doctors not wanting to talk about the drug, it kills people and so on. And it's just one of these two drugs are like, they're safer than aspirin for sure. They may even be safer than Tylenol.
Right.
Long-term use of these drugs does not cause liver problems, and long-term use of Tylenol can. So it's quite bizarre that two of the safest drugs I've ever investigated. I mean, I didn't know. I went in as an expert in adverse drug effects, and I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe how textbooks, like that, my classic textbook for medical school is still out there. Goodman and Gelman is talking about how hydroxychloroquine is unusually safe. They don't talk like that in textbooks. And then, provided you don't exceed the toxic dose. So,
that's crazy.
Did you end up spending actual much time with the ivermectin docs and with the FLCCC, the frontline docs?
Yeah, I am going to more in the future. I've spent hours. I was on their Zoom calls sort of on the inside when they were forming a nonprofit and getting support from, you know, people all around the world. Chris Martinson, who does a, you know, Peak Prosperity broadcast, and Jeff Hansen, who's a philanthropist who leads the Unity Project, and Betsy Ashton. I mean, one of the things that gives me great hope about our ability to fight this great reset is that you see people from all across the political spectrum who are basically called, like I was and like you are, way out ahead of all of us, to say no, that this can't happen. And, you know, Betsy Ashton and Pierre Corey. Betsy Ashton was a CBS correspondent. A liberal correspondent, and Joyce Kamen, who's a brilliant PR person in Cincinnati, and they are just total fighters for this. And they've noticed that a lot of liberals, who is sort of a divide, I think, between humanitarian liberals and authoritarian liberals. And, you know, I don't want to label people. A lot of people are just dealing with incomplete information. But I can see that conservatives, libertarians, and humanitarian liberals, I guess I would call it, coming together in a kind of new political force, maybe a lot of it populism, to oppose this around ivermectin and around hydroxychloroquine. Because if the number one idea of the Great Reset is to erase the pillars of the civilization and of our humanity, I mean, the intimacy between a doctor and a patient is right up there with any, just about anything, mother and child, you know. And I think people are fighting all around the world for that.
I think one of the reasons they want it so badly and have succeeded to some great extent to destroy the doctor-patient relationship was precisely because that's the kind of thing that stands in the way of an inhumane globalism that wants to exploit people. You have a bond there. You have intelligent people working together and writing things, and it's like religion, the medicine, religion has to be taken down. Everything with meaning that could supersede globalism and make people rebel. Kind of like, you know, during slavery, they didn't teach the slaves to read, and they kind of discouraged them from having, you know, their own religious services. They would have secret Christian meetings. Because anything that bonds people and gives them higher ideals is the enemy of globalism. And they acknowledge that openly in their books and articles and stuff.
Right, right. One of the things that gives me hope is when I was with the Philadelphia Inquirer, I interviewed one of the most famous scientists in the world. He recently died, E.O. Wilson at Harvard University, who was considered the Darwin of the 20th century and the greatest.
Yeah.
Anyway, he told me, and he was a famous atheist and didn't believe in God. I believe in God. but his writings helped me believe in God, because he said, if you were to take a bunch of, say, he gave the example of New Yorkers, and they decided to form an alternative society underground, watching only avant-garde films for 1 million years, and they came up into the air and saw the vistas, the savannah, the trees of Central Park for the first time, they would weep in joy, because it's in their DNA. He said 1 million years is not enough time to propagandize out of our hearts and minds and our DNA the love of doctor and patient, the love of mother and husband and wife. And so good luck on it. They're 3 years into it. They're into it. They're headed for a 1,000-year culture war, because it's the most ignorant, unscientific, inhumane, unliterary view of human nature imaginable. You know? Anyway, sorry.
Just talking, I think people might be interested in a little bit more about the God issue, because, you know, I was shocked a number of years back when I read Darwin's book about humanity, which is The Descent of Man. And it was nothing like E.O. Wilson was saying, nothing like I'd heard about in classes, nothing that progressives were saying. I mean, the survival of the fittest concept, he had literally given up by the time he got to The Descent of Man. And I got one of these concordiums, I think they're called.
Wow.
And I looked at all the words, how many words they got. And they had survival of the fittest was 3 times mentioned, and twice he criticized his own concept. And love was mentioned dozens and dozens of times. E.O. Wilson, these barbaric, they're very much the transhumanists of today. You know, they never talk about love. And Darwin said that the highest human achievements could not have happened from biological evolution. They were intellectual leaps that human beings made with the intellect they were given. And he considered he'd been trained as a minister, like a lot of people had been in those days. And he said man's highest achievement, he believed this great leap, was the golden rule. And for most of his life, he believed in God. And I think when he wrote, and he said that God breathed light into these substances to make them organic, to make them have life potential. But later in life, he actually gave up his firmness of his belief. In a series of letters, he said, "I am absolutely not an atheist." He said what so many people struggle with, and nothing to do with science at all. He said, "There's so much misery on earth. How can we have a loving God? I'm in disbelief. I'm agnostic. I can't explain it." Now that's a spiritual man struggling with spiritual issues.
Right.
And he's
right.
Never portrayed that way in ordinary educational settings or in books.
Oh boy, that's fascinating. I had no idea.
Yeah, I actually published an article on that subject in Scientific Hypotheses, or whatever that journal is. About hypotheses, new hypotheses in science. It shouldn't have been, but the evolution journals I sent it to want nothing to do with it. They wouldn't even review it. They said our people wouldn't like it.
Unbelievable.
And I also put it in the back of my book on guilt, shame, and anxiety, because I talk about the evolution of humanity, and I point out that Darwin actually saw human beings as liberated from a pure evolution. He even thought that dogs had an element of morality in them, and that they certainly had spirits, that they had joy and pleasure.
That's remarkable.
Isn't it? It's all different than you would think. And it's all in the one book, which is his book about humans. But instead, they read him about lower animals. And they read The Survival of the Fittest, which he no longer believed. He said that and this is really actually important for folks. He said that what survives in nature is what adapts to this changing environment, and what has the proper genes to adapt to the environment. So if you're getting a lot of rain and your environment and you can't get out of it, and you develop fins, maybe by accident, and maybe you'll be swimming and somebody else will be drowning. But it's an adaptation. He did not see it as a competition. He saw it more as an individual adaptation. adapting to the world in the best way. And he saw human beings as having free will. He saw human beings as changing their lives and loving and having higher ideals. It's amazing how they stripped him down into this kind of warrior dog-eat-dog thing. I mean, the progressives are just so unreliable. It's on every level.
That is phenomenal. That is amazing.
Oh, I'm glad that's interesting to you.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's phenomenal. I get hope from literary sources like...
Well, we only got 10, 12 seconds left, so give us a quickie and then we'll go
ivermectin,
on.
Ivermectin, here's a little headline. Ivermectin in a Brazilian city of 150,000, it prevented like 70% of deaths just in prevention, with 129,000 people took it. So...
Yeah, this stuff works beautifully. It's worked for family members of mine. Okay, folks, we will be back very soon after the break. Well, welcome back again. I'm going to call you my wonderful audience again. We were talking with Mike Capuzzo, who's a great writer and who encourages writers and has a wonderful platform of his own. And I think is doing some things. He's certainly reprinting the stuff that we write and put up on America Out Loud. If you want to hear, folks, you want to hear me do a radio show with Ginger, go to America Out Loud and find it. And if you want to see me and Ginger alternating sometimes, but writing, one of us at least writes a column every week, we're doing this because of just the wonderful relationship we have with Malcolm, who is the founder of this wonderful platform, and it's America Out Loud, and Leave Elite writes on it, MD, and McCullough writes on it. And you've been putting stuff up on your website from there, right? From us.
And we run your column regularly. We started really the first mainstream, you know, mainstream journalism has a bad name, and I think for good reason, but we're really, my wife and I are probably the first people with sort of top mainstream journalism credentials to start a platform on Substack called Rescue that reports all this as if, you know, I worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Miami Herald for 17 years and have written for Esquire and the Sports Illustrated and got, you can just about name anything, Reader's Digest and Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. And I have good friends at the Washington Post and some at the New York Times, they're old colleagues, and we're not friends on this issue, obviously. But we've been getting out the word, hiring some mainstream reporters, investigative reporters. Mary Beth Pfeiffer did a story for us that forced the Times and the Post to run corrections on ivermectin. And, you know, it's just the biggest story in the world. So go to rescue.substack.com and you can see our stuff and read your columns. We're building a new journalism, and we're looking for writers who are interested in this kind of thing, and artists and photographers too. I did a story when I first started following Pierre Corey and Paul Merrick and the FLCCC, and I could not believe that they were blacked out, and the ivermectin story was blacked out by mainstream media. I approached the Wall Street Journal, I approached my friends at the Washington Post to see if I could write about it, and of course was told no, because no one could write about it. So my wife and I are also magazine publishers. We publish a magazine called Mountain Home.
Wonderful magazine.
Yeah, thanks. And it's not too far from you in Ithaca. We're in a small town in Pennsylvania. And we have 100,000 readers from, say, Cornell University region to, say, Penn State. And it's my wife grew up in a town of 3,000 in the middle of the mountains here. So here we are, a beautiful little town. Anyway, so on Mountain Home, we've won like 150 journalism awards. I mean, it's a great little magazine. And Teresa said, you know what, Mike, stop worrying that the Wall Street Journal won't write it. Write it for us. So it became a local story for us, ivermectin, because I basically retold the tale of Judith Smenowitz, an 80-year-old grandmother in Buffalo, who was one of the first women. And you're right, Peter, ivermectin does have a lot of preventive and early benefits, but also it seems to have a miraculous effect to people on ventilators. And doctors in Buffalo had given up on her. She was on death's door, and she got ivermectin through a lawsuit. and was off the ventilator within 24 hours and is now home with her family at 80 years old. And I told her story in context of the efforts of Merrick and Corey to bring this story to the world. And it was a really, really peculiar thing in the current media world where, thank God, podcasts like this and live broadcasts have allowed the truth to get out in so many formats. On the other hand, there's really not a lot of, I wrote a 10,000-word narrative story about her life and about what the doctors did for her. And I thought, well, what kind of impact in a small magazine can that have? Well, it turned out I got a congratulations from the Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Amura in Japan, who invented ivermectin.
Okay.
Doctors in Taiwan and in Poland translated it into their languages, all 10,000 words, to said to try to save lives in our country. But maybe the most amazing thing, and that is the most amazing thing, but maybe the most heartening thing as far as the media goes, is I was talking as one of the Dr. Tess Laurie invited me to talk at this in England at this Better World, Better Way conference that a lot of your audience probably knows about. She was sort of the Pierre Corey of England, for lack of another way to put it, in discovering ivermectin. And I talked about my experience in writing for this small magazine my wife and I publish. And Brett Weinstein, who does the Dark Horse podcast, said, Mike, you know what? I read your story. And it was back when I was saying WTF about the media and WTF about ivermectin and WTF about Pierre Corey, because he sure, this is Brett Weinstein, he sure seemed like a good guy to me, but I couldn't make a mistake on my podcast. He said, and then I read your story, and I said, what the hell is Mountain Home in the middle of nowhere, this obscure magazine? It should be in the Atlantic. It's so beautifully written, and it should have won the Pulitzer Prize. He said, but your story convinced me Pierre Corey was the real deal. And he had him on his podcast, and then they went on the Joe Rogan podcast. So it sort of helped change history and hopefully save a lot of lives. And I don't say that out of pride or boasting. I say that because I think it gives us hope that the human story, the well-told tale, even in print, even in a little magazine, these are things that the digital gods of tech don't even think are possible, you know. So that gives me hope.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. I want to give a little bit of background on this ivermectin and on hydroxychloroquine. There is an actual legal reason why they had to, throughout the world, do everything in their power to suppress any drug that already existed, was already passed through the FDA system, so its safety had been established, why they had to prevent them. And that is that the Authorization Act, the EUA, the Emergency Use Authorization, has a clause, like many emergency acts do, that you can't go to the emergency if you have one effective treatment.
Right.
Safe and effective treatment. All it had to have been done is to be approved by the FDA for anything, and then doctors could use it, and if it was effective, then you couldn't, then the whole thing of giving billions of dollars to a few drug companies and for poisonous drugs and poisonous vaccines would have fallen down legally. Somebody could have gone to court and just said no more. And I think they've run into that problem with trying to bring out some of the drugs, because if one of the drugs actually proved really useful, they legally couldn't push the vaccines anymore. So they got right. A little bit into a bind. And the bind was, we just want to do the vaccines. We said in 2010 that we were going to do vaccines, and we got all these investors in, and we've been working on it for 10 years, and here we got it, and we're not going to lose it. But the other, you've already mentioned, the other issue, Mike, was that, of course, if you have drugs that are proven to prevent 70% of deaths and 80% of hospitalizations, as one review showed by McCullough, if you can do that, people aren't going to just kill themselves going for the vaccine. They're just going to take the drugs and get better. And you certainly couldn't give them to children. And they've been determined to give them to everybody, including children. Again, it's just a mass murder of children. The children won't die of the disease, but they are dying of vaccines. So, and I think the reason for that is their ultimate aim is to make us submissive. If you can get mothers to, and fathers to sacrifice their children for on drugs, which if the parents listened or looked a little bit, they would learn the kids are not in danger of dying, but they are from the disease. You could have parties to get the disease and they would get a better immunity than they would ever get from the vaccines. And they'd bring a herd and or community immunity. I mean, the only scientific thing possible with the children, by whom I mean really 20 and below, maybe even 30 and below, not to give them a vaccine, this vaccine ever, but to let them have the disease and treat it properly. And a lot of them won't even know they were sick. So there's a whole bunch of things that came together that they absolutely had to stop hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. And then Fauci had already been through this with the AIDS epidemic. He kept saying, you got to wait for the vaccine. No, there are no treatments. And a lot of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people died from the pneumonia, the bacterial pneumonia that goes along with the immune deficiency disease. They could have been saved, and Fauci wouldn't do it. And what people don't know is that there was a huge demonstration in front of Fauci's building on NIH by the gay community and their supporters during the early days.
Right.
We haven't seen that happen now because they'd all be afraid of an insurrection.
Well, one of the things I think, Peter, one of the things I think is remarkable about you and your book, Ginger, is with your background as a psychiatrist, every time you talk about this, you go a lot deeper than people who are just talking the medicine itself or the biology of the medicine or the politics, because you go right to the human soul and the corruptions of evil, I guess. And it reminds me in some ways of this famous psychiatrist or psychologist, he is not as well known as you, but maybe my book helped make him well known, named Richard Walter, who was considered the living Sherlock Holmes. He's a forensic scientist and forensic psychologist.
Yeah.
He's considered the living Sherlock Holmes at Scotland Yard, et cetera. And he's about 80 years old now, and he's really the reigning expert in the West of sadism and serial killers and what motivates them and the little dark thrills they get and the journey they're on. And he talks about how what the Great Reset and the WTF and everything have done to us is it has elements of sadism. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes, I'd go further and say they're clearly murderous.
They're definitely murderers, but the way they're attacking the human spirit, sort of.
Oh, I think so. Well, I think murderers are probably, I mean, conscious, deliberate, scheming murderers are almost by definition sadists. They're getting power out of it.
Right.
See, they're really, I think they're the psychological, main psychological quality, I think, of people who do these really extreme serial murders is the same that we see in the globalists, and it's power over people.
Right.
Quite often it's power over women, but with these guys, it's indiscriminate. It's power over humanity.
Right.
And with that, I think sadism, yes. I mean, the Nazis, many of them were awful sadists and they were torturing people. But they're sadists in the sense that having power over people. And if you go back
right.
and look at the Marquis de Sade, and I mean, a lot of that's about power, tying people up and stuff like that. So, yeah, they want to have power over people. And that explains so much. But if you don't face it. And by the way, you can put this up on your website. That's the subject of my most recent column on Malcolm Out Loud. It's that we're not the same. They're not the same as us. We're different from them. And I describe this brutal kind of way of viewing life where they actually think we are just a problem in the way of getting their food, they're getting their outdoor space, they're having their ocean, you know, they're having their freedom,
right.
They're having their cars. We're in a way of all of that. They're not out for equality. They're out for servitude. They're like feudal lords. I think like feudal lords or empire builders, and I compare them to empire builders often.
And they've exceeded all the empire. I've written about that too. They've exceeded them. You know, I mean, Alexander's not so great compared to the people.
Oh, I would love to read that.
200 countries.
Oh, I love that, Alexander.
Yeah,
yes.
And I, the book I called wrote about Richard Walters called The Murder Room. And one of the things that he, in Catching Serial Killers and everything, he'll say there was a famous, terribly grotesque crime in Australia where a woman was brutalized with a bunch of, you know, and murdered and all the horrible things you could imagine. And the police called of New South Wales, which is the biggest police agency in the world, or one of them, called him in and said, come to Australia and help us. Who did this? And he said, a whole group did it. And I'll tell you what to do. This is connects to Klaus Schwab, I think. I'll tell you what to do. Go in the bars and send all your men and women, all your agents into the bars in New South Wales, because they're going to brag about it.
Yes.
There's a certain type of sadistic or power-driven killer. It doesn't count unless people know. So I'm always struck how Klaus Schwab tells us the most monstrous, inhuman things he's going to do before he does it. And keeps telling us over and over and over.
Yeah. Bill Gates gets that cute little grin when he talks about how, well, of course, we could reach zero, emissions if we didn't have people.
Right, exactly.
God.
A little dark humor, I guess.
A little dark humor. Oh, I think it's so deeper than that. But this is interesting. I haven't had this kind of conversation often on my show. Ginger and I have these conversations. I've written a fairly extensive, I think, folks, that you'll really find it interesting on the Malcolm's website,
America.
We'll America. So tell me more about your own thinking. I mean, you're pretty psychologically oriented. I don't think you should sort of give more credibility to psychiatrists or psychologists than to yourself. Honestly, beyond that. And
well, thank you. I appreciate what you're saying. I draw my inspiration from literary sources. And I guess before personal profession, you know, Shakespeare, Freud came in and stole all the wisdoms of Shakespeare, pretended they were his, right? But, I look for inspiration at them because, Solzhenitsyn says the same thing, you know, when he was fighting the gulag in the Soviet Union, which is we are fighting in our own way now. Says the same thing that Winston Churchill said in the pressure of World War II. He said, in crisis, you realize humanity is spiritual. And I do think that's our edge. Just what you were saying about Darwin. They literally, our opponents literally can't conceive of that, you know? And
they don't want to hear about it, so they expunge it from him. They don't want human beings think that they have inherent value and can rise above their circumstances, their biology, and their genetics. They don't want us to think like that. And I had not thought about it before this way, but that's one reason why they had to completely misrepresent Charles Darwin to the public.
Which is amazing. Well, they misrepresent Dr. Martin Luther King, is really Reverend Martin Luther King, and as important as the wonderful, you know, martyr and visionary of India, Gandhi was, Christ was more important. And that's not the story you get, you know.
Yeah, well, yes, you're not going to hear about the importance of Jesus to Mahatma Gandhi or to Martin Luther King, and you're not going to hear his importance, never mind to Christianity, but to the evolution of thinking in the world. I mean, he talked in a different way about love and a loving God and love for one another, and I say that as a Jew. I believe it is undeniable, and all of that has to go in order to rule the world and crush rebellion. You can't let people think they have inherent value. You can't let them treasure each other or even love each other. You want to divide them up. So every time you see something really ugly going on, dividing blacks and whites, women and men and so on, it's all a part of muddying our social potential to be a group that stands up to them.
Right. You know, you sound, Naomi Wolf's new book, I just started reading, it sounds like she's quoting you, because she talks about the power, you know, the incredible power of getting together and singing on a Wednesday night with your friends, or going to church, or going to a baseball game, and how people network much more effectively than they do on Facebook and meet each other and create new ideas, mm-hmm. and fight back. You know, and so the idea they're trying to move us and successfully moving us to this metaverse of digital, you know, control instead of those things, you
That's
know.
one reason they were harder on the churches than most places in terms of closing them down. That's where people get together. You know, the progressives reject the idea that churches are actually places of community. They're community centers, most of them.
Right.
They're doing their job right. And they are places where people get strength to support the community. Again, you can't have that in a global world. The global world is a world of a very limited number of elites controlling everybody else, period.
Peter, can I ask you a question? Because you're the master psychologist of this movement. I really believe that. And if there's anything I can do as a journalist is figure out what's what, and that's you. And how do we approach, I'd like to come back on again and talk about this sometime if I could think more, ask more questions. How do we approach our neighbors, our friends, who just won't even, I have scientist relatives who have PhDs, brilliant men. And when I wrote the story that got a Nobel Prize winner to send me a congratulations, they won't even read it. They become instantly hostile, instantly tribal, instantly political. How do we talk to our families? The news this week that vaccines are going to be in our babies, and we know there's overwhelming evidence that the risk, you know, profile is just monstrous against that. How do we convince our neighbors? How do we show them things? Or can we? What's our hope? How do we do it?
Well, you gave me 2 minutes. I was asked this question a closing night in a conference I was doing for some doctors in the southeast of the U.S. And the answer I gave the doctor who asked almost the identical question, really the identical question, was, firstly, you'll be disappointed with my answer. I think that we shouldn't try too hard with our families if they don't want to listen. And all we can do is occasionally remind them or occasionally send them a video or occasionally send them a book, but keep your love relationship because that's where you're going to influence them. And they will see you as potentially an example, perhaps when things go to pot, if you still have a loving relationship with them. So I have kept my reform work mostly out of family relationships, and let them see what I'm doing and know what I'm doing and, you know, that kind of thing. And the energy goes into where it'll work, which is with the general public. We have so many people who are on the fence and uncertain and looking for answers. And to take that half the country, I do believe, or more, that is more on our side, but's never heard the story properly, and get it to them. And so I don't encourage people to really try too hard with their families. Certainly don't argue with them. Arguing is useless. But, you know, set an example, let them know what you're doing. But put that energy where it's going to work, volunteering, supporting media, becoming a media, writing for people, giving talks in public or at the library, wherever you can get a chance. But, with all of my experience, I would say do not break your heart or your family's hearts over this issue. It doesn't work well.
Religious traditions, too, of the most successful thing is to model things rather than, you know, thank you. Gives me a little peace of mind.
Want to give you a peace of mind. I think we're over peace of mind here. Oh, my God, Mike Capuzzo, a pleasure. Just very wonderful to have you on. And I do want to meet you someday, and we'll get together. We're not that far apart. God bless you, sir. Ginger loves you, and I'm sure would want to send her love to you. Bye-bye, wonderful audience.